Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the film Concrete Soldiers, about redevelopment of our cities. At least, that's what it's called, but often it means knocking our estates down. With one of the filmmakers, Andy Worthington. Also, one of the inventors of the crop circle back in the 1970s. His name's Doug Bauer, and he died this summer. We speak to one of his friends, Matt Williams. A disability living allowance. Well, many disabled people are finding that they've got to have their benefits taken away. And then if they want to get them back enough to live on, then they have to appeal. Particularly, this is particularly bad for disabled people. And Fran is one of them. She joins us too. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name's Andy Worthington. I'm a London-based journalist and activist, and I'm the narrator of this new documentary film made by a woman called Nikita Wolf, looking at the destruction of council estates currently in the UK. It's focused on London, but the picture is something that's playing out across the whole of the UK, and I would say in many significant ways globally.
Well, what,
the destruction of council estates, and the film is about the resistance of residents to the destruction of their homes.
I mean, isn't this just being London-centric again for its own sake? I mean, there's council estates all over the country, aren't there?
There are, yeah. I mean, Nikki made the film because she lives in London, and she was making the film on a shoestring about places that were within an easy radius for her. So she actually lives next door to the Aylesbury estate, which is one of the big estates in Southwark, which is being destroyed. The Southwark story is quite exemplary, of a much bigger picture. So to be honest, I think focusing on Southwark and Lambeth isn't really London-centric, because the things that the film tells about what's happening to our council estates is a much more universal story.
But isn't London a little bit like a kind of pressure cooker for the rest of the country? It's house prices being so much higher there than anywhere else.
Well, I think it makes the corruption more readily accessible in London, that, you know, councils are sitting on such vast assets in terms of the land values that it, you know, probably adds fire to the fuel of their wishing to dispossess their constituents anyway.
Okay, so...
But at some very fundamental level, what's happening here is that councils, locally elected officials, who are elected by the people not with a mandate to destroy social housing, are actually destroying social housing, and are doing that using a variety of excuses and lies and spin about why they're doing that.
Let's get down to brass tacks then, because this is what we need to know. What excuses are being used, what methods are being used by the developers to twist the arms of councillors, and how are they getting people into positions where actually maybe they don't even need to twist their arm that much.
Right.
That they're actually there to facilitate development, not to represent local people.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is... It's definitely what's happening is that the council's only excuse for any of their actions is that they have been severely squeezed of cash by central government. This has clearly been happening since the Tories got in.
Okay, and the land they own is the family silver.
Yes, exactly. But then that's a whole reason why so much privatisation is such a bad idea, Tony, anyway, when public servants are selling their own assets in whatever field it is and losing that value forever once it's gone. But having been put into this position where they have been strapped for cash by central government, they have then been getting into bed with private developers, who are the only people who seem to be able to have the money to help them with their housing targets and their housing needs. But these are developers who want to make a large profit themselves. The only profit that they can see is by knocking down existing council estates and replacing them with brand new properties that are going to be generally unaffordable for local people.
Can you just give me one or two examples from the capital? Because I think it'd be interesting to see whether they are Labour or Conservative-run councils.
Well, two-thirds of the councils in London are Labour-run. A lot of these stories involve Labour councils. And in fact, some of the most notorious examples involve Labour councils. And Labour is fully implicated in this. But having said that, I wouldn't want to start suggesting that Tory councils are not bad as well. Everybody's in on it. the exemplary borough, really, for the for what's been going on is Southwark. Now, Southwark's, you know, close to the City of London, so therefore the pressures of money are huge. And so developers were after land. And the first big and terrible story was of the Haygate Estate, which is a council estate right in the centre of the Elephant and Castle, where the developers are Lendlease, the Australian-owned international property development company. Southwark, what you find a lot of the time is that the councils are not really very good at understanding the value of their own assets. So they sold this land to Lendlease without really making any money themselves. Lendlease has knocked down the whole of this huge estate, is replacing it with a new development called Elephant Park.
Okay, the obvious thing, let me stop you there, is what happens to all those people, thousands of people living?
They're scattered to the winds.
Are they just told, right, you're out?
Yeah, I mean, they were basically, if you rented, you were evicted when they began the whole process of decanting the blocks to move people out. It's hard to work out exactly where everybody went because the councils say, no, nobody really suffered. Everybody's still living locally. But analysis that's been done by researchers, and there are some amazing researchers in Southwark, has established that, no, people are being swept out boroughs beyond where they were living and out of London completely in many cases.
So this is what we call social cleansing.
It is what we call social cleansing. And, you know, what's kind of crucial is to understand about some of the things that are happening is that there's some very clear corruption taking place, Tony. So there's a revolving door between the councils and the developers in a lot of cases where people who've had jobs involving housing in the councils have then miraculously gone on to get jobs with the developers. So that one's really obvious. But the other thing that you can't help wondering about a lot of the time is that these people who are elected by the people quite often seem to despise people who are living in social housing, people who are poorer. What they have is this vision of a new group of people who are a bit more affluent, moving in and living in these new properties because that's their notion of what vibrant modern cities should be looking
like. Hang on, that sounds like gentrification.
Yes, there you go. So social cleansing in Gretton and gentrification, these are exactly what
listen, the only thing I really want to hear now is what about the fight back? Any successful fight backs against this by local people?
Well, the film looks at a small success, actually, in some sheltered housing. Architect designed sheltered housing in Streatham. The architect is a woman called Kate McIntosh, who got involved in the fight to save this place from Lambeth Council and was successful. And she involved, you know, heritage bodies and other architects. But what we've seen lately in London is even that's not sufficient. So there's a famous block called Robin Hood Gardens, two blocks in Tower Hamlets. Architect designed, internationally acclaimed Tower Hamlets Council, you know, they've knocked down one half of these two blocks just over the last few months. There's a hideous new development going up. It doesn't seem like there's any kind of protection anymore that can be provided to stop the developers. But of course, the scale of things that are happening is such that the story's getting out more. And I think the more the story gets out, hopefully the more people will actually come to realize that the scale of what's happening means that we could easily, within the next few years, see tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of people up and down the country displaced from where they were living, dropping off the radar, ending up, you know, with no rights, no protection in a vulnerable, overheated private rental market, which, of course, is, you know, a huge problem anyway.
Well, look, we can't talk about housing in London without mentioning Grenfell Tower. I mean, what do you make of what's happened there? Because it's feasible, isn't it, that this is going to be another long, long inquiry like Hillsborough, this kind of thing, and will anything change as a result?
I think that things will change in that they will have to look at what they did and understand that at every point, from central government down to local government, down to the management company that was given the management of the social housing blocks, to the various contractors involved, had all sat back complacently, put profit before safety, and they're going to have to change the way that they operate. I mean, the shocking thing with Grenfell at the moment is that public and private blocks around the country are clad in dangerously flammable cladding. And yet, if you were living in those blocks, you could be going to sleep every night really terrified that where you live is a potential death trap like Grenfell, and yet nobody is in a hurry to do anything about it. I think that's a pretty scandalous and a pretty serious indictment of the government, which kind of confirms what we learned from Grenfell, which is that we really have a class of second-class citizens in this country, which is people who live in social housing tower blocks, because Grenfell showed that you can literally be killed by inaction or by an entire system that has failed in its job, which is that you should be safe in your own
home. Well, there are calls for people to be arrested for the trials for this, because, I mean, it was quite clear that people weren't sticking to the regulations.
Yes.
It looks as if they've, you know, just got off scot-free.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we will have to see, Tony, won't we, what an inquiry leads to. But, I mean, I think, without wishing to sound cynical, inquiries generally take a long time, lead to some gentle rapping on the wrists. And behind the scenes, there might be a slight tightening of certain things. I think that after Grenfell, what needs to happen is that if you're dealing with safety issues involving homes and people's lives in tower blocks, the notion that we've ended up in this absurd, complacent world where very clearly flammable material has been used on buildings, and that then compromises the structural integrity of the buildings, turning them literally into what happened at Grenfell. I mean, just an inferno, is so absurd that that has to stop. But like I say, when we're looking at 14 months on, this insanely dangerous cladding still being on hundreds of tower blocks around the country, nobody in a position of power and authority wants to pull out the checkbook and say, look, I don't care how much it costs, we have to do this. So that contempt is quite deeply ingrained, I think, for other people's lives. And I think what that reveals about our political class and about various people involved in the building industry is very damning.
Sounds like what you're saying is it hasn't really been that much of a wake-up call for the industry, that the developers are just carrying on almost regardless.
Well, I think we're in a bit of an absurd situation, Tony, where councils don't necessarily have the kind of money that they can readily access for things. I'm not trying to let them off the hook here. I think they shouldn't be using that. I think they really should be prioritising. But I know, we know some councils are now, you know, so deep in debt that the whole structure seems to be falling apart.
Well, Northampton's gone bankrupt,
right,
actually, hasn't it?
So with private contractors, though, what's happening is that, you know, this wrangling is going on between who built the properties, the insurers, you know, and all of this stuff is taking months to unfold as to who's actually going to foot the bill, so that people who bought properties that they thought were homes, that they thought were safe, are going to actually end up living in homes that are safe.
Well, look, back to Concrete Soldiers and privatisation, so-called redevelopment, which for many people say really just means demolition. Tell us a little bit about how people can find the film online and, you know, how we can follow it. Is it available to watch on YouTube, things like that? And
not yet, it isn't, although we're hoping to do that quite soon. So it's Concrete Soldiers UK. We'll help people to find it. There's a trailer on there. There's information about it. You know, I would hope that we can bring it back to Bristol and show it again. And I also encourage anyone who's really interested in these issues to get in touch with us, because we can make the film available for you to see. It's one of the things that we're particularly trying to do, is to get people who are affected by these issues to be able to watch the film.
So you're touring with the film and then you're having a discussion at the same time?
Yeah, definitely. The discussions tend to be really interesting, actually, because once people get engaged with the issues, and a lot of people don't realise the scale of what's going on, Tony. This is a massive land grab, you know, and behind all the stories about needing to knock down old estates and build new properties is just insane amounts of money. And that's why nowhere is safe, really. Anywhere that you have real estate that you look at, that people, unscrupulous people involved in the development industry want to get their hands on, and, you know, international bankers, nowhere's safe. And people, I think, need to be aware of that.
They say safe as houses, don't they? And that's what they love more than anything else to invest in, because it's going to give them a massive return. Okay, so it's over a longer period than a lot of investors want, but you're going to get your money back and some, guaranteed. So why wouldn't they want to do this? Anyway, fascinating stuff. Concrete Soldiers is the film. If you want to find it online, Concrete Soldiers UK. Andy Worthington, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tony. All
dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Matthew Williams and I'm 47 years of age. Live in Wiltshire for the last 20 years. I've got the unusual distinction of being the only person ever to be arrested for making crop circles. And here today to talk about the death of Doug Bower and how he is remembered by the crop circle community for being the man that started it all off.
So how did he do that and when?
Well, Doug actually was in Australia and he saw a news report that there had been a thing called a saucer nest, which was a reed bed, had a circular mark pressed down into it. And the researchers in the area in Australia had come to the conclusion that it had been an alien craft had landed in this reed bed and created this saucer shape, this round circular shape. And Doug had this in the back of his mind when he came back to the UK from Australia. And he was wandering along the hillside in Hampshire near Cheesfoot Head. And he said to his friend Dave, he said, wouldn't it be really good if somebody put something like a circle down in that field of crop there? And if everybody thought that it was a UFO had landed.
So when was this? What year are we talking about?
Oh, God.
Roughly.
I think we're talking in the 80s here. And I can't remember exactly when, but you'll have to edit that. But in the 1980s, this was the kind of, you know, the period when Doug started. And he said that his friend came out with him, Dave Chorley, and they went out into the field, put the circle down there with, I believe it was just rolling sort of a bar, a security bar, by his hands. So they weren't even using stomper boards at that point, you know, which are, for anybody that doesn't know, a stomper board is a plank of wood with a piece of rope over it, and you basically put it on the end of your foot and you can flatten a large area by pressing down. These guys actually had a security bar which was used in his studios, because Doug was an artist, and his studios had this on the door as a security measure. So they carried this big heavy bar down with them, and they actually rolled it with their hands on the ground and rolled it down into the shape of a circle. And he said, lo and behold, the next day, the TV crews from all over the world were flocking in to see this circle that appeared in the cornfield.
Do we know where this cornfield is, where the first one was?
I think he said it was Cheesefoot Head in Hampshire, so not far from Salisbury.
Whereabouts nowadays do most of the crop circles appear? Because, I mean, apparently in all sorts of parts of the world, but definitely centred around this part of Wiltshire.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Whereabouts do the crop circles appear nowadays?
Well, most crop circles appear in Wiltshire. It has become the home for them. It started in Hampshire because that was where Doug and Dave actually started all this stuff off. So they were working in Hampshire in the south, and there was even a crop circle team that was kind of dedicated towards Andover Way, which is Hampshire, and one in Southampton. And it kind of then drifted from being Hampshire into Wiltshire, where it's kind of stayed ever since. And I mean, this is the epicentre. Wiltshire is now the epicentre. But I mean, it's spread all over the world. You've got the Czech Republic, Germany, Norway, Belgium, France. I mean, those are the European countries. But then you go across the other side of the world, you've got, you know, America, obviously, Brazil, Chile. You've got them in Australia, New Zealand. You know, it really has covered the whole world. But I mean, this is the influence that these two artists, Doug and Dave, have had in starting this art form, which was originally intended as kind of a joke and to see whether they could fool people, but ended up becoming something which Doug even says in it, you know, towards the end of his circle making career, he believes that there was genuine interest from a paranormal sphere in the circles that they designed. People believed that these things were real, they had real paranormal effects in them, and Doug even said that he felt that he was being guided by some unknown higher force to actually create them.
Was he being sucked into his own hoax?
I think he was a little bit taken aback. He believed at first that people were kind of trying to cash in on this and you know, try to cash in on a gullible public. And he was actually doing quite a lot behind the scenes to contact researchers like Colin Andrews and even went up to them in conferences and would tap them on the shoulder and actually tell them how a circle like that could be made and circumstances behind how it could be done. And Colin Andrews at the time was very dismissive because, you know, everyone believed that it couldn't be done by people. So, you know, he didn't even realise that the circle maker was actually speaking to him. And Colin does actually have a vague memory. Colin Andrews, by the way, is one of the world's most renowned crop circle researchers, written books on it. He's one of the most famous guys in the world, has eventually come to the conclusion that it is people making crop circles, but he has these memories of this elderly guy, Doug, coming up to him and telling him these things. So he does remember this, you know, that
say the public are gullible, but also the press are very gullible. Do you think that maybe they wanted to believe this and they weren't interested in checking the facts or what?
Well, I think in hindsight, they didn't have the information at the time, so they went with whatever these researchers were telling them. Some of these researchers had professional credentials, doctors, professors, people who weren't actually professors but claiming to be professors that were exposed later. All sorts of specialists and experts came along to add their theories into what could be creating the crop circles. And I think that the press does have a tendency to go with sensational rather than explanation sometimes. I mean, in my own spheres of research, I've noticed that if you find a UFO story, the press are interested in it. If you find out an explanation for the UFO story, the press aren't quite so interested in the explanation. It's just the nature of the press. So the nature of the beast is that initially this was told to them as being something paranormal, something UFO alien, Mother Earth crying out and creating these shapes, whatever it was that was doing it, it wasn't humans. That was the one thing everybody was very, very clear on. It couldn't be humans doing it. And so, therefore, the press ran with it in the spirit that it was being given to them.
Well, you say the press, but I can remember, certainly as a reporter in London, being asked to do stories on crop circles. It was mostly the Murdoch press, largely the Sun. Wow. And if you think about when it all started in the 80s, you know, that was when Murdoch had taken over these papers. I wonder if it was a sort of Murdoch... had something to do with this phenomenon in making it, you know, international.
Well, I don't know if Murdoch in particular, I mean, I don't know enough about it to say really, but what I would say is that sensationalism and press, you know, they do like the UFO stories and ghost stories. They're kind of, they're considered padding and fillers, you know, but then the press obviously cotton onto the thing that, you know, if they put a UFO story in the newspapers, people read them like crazy, you know. It gets a sort of really rage reviews and rage sort of views. So they've cottoned onto the idea of...
Hang on, it's fake news.
Well, is it fake news? That's the thing. I mean, you know, people, this is part of the debate, you know. Are Doug and Dave, were they hoaxers? Well, are they hoaxing something or are they creating the real phenomena? You know, and this is where you have to sort of cross the line and understand that, you know, Banksy isn't hoaxing artwork. You know, he is creating artwork and how people perceive it is up to them.
Yeah, but it's no one saying that Banksy's are made by aliens, are they? Are they?
Well, nobody knows who's Banksy is. So, I mean, he could be operating from a UFO outside in orbit and collecting royalties, you know, in bank accounts on Earth to spend on Smarties. I don't know. But, I mean, from Doug and Dave's point of view, they didn't really want money from it and they didn't really want fame. But the reason they came forward to tell people what they'd done is because they could see the way that this was getting out of hand in the press. And even though they knew that people were getting a lot of interest from it and they were having paranormal experiences, and it was really, as Doug described it, it was getting out of control. You know, he'd started something that really had taken on its own life and gone way beyond what he'd ever expected, but they felt that it was time to kind of come forward and tell people. So they came forward in the Today newspaper, and there was an expose where they took them out and showed them how it was done, explained the story with them. You know, they didn't tell their wives what they were doing. They were just pretending they were going out doing sound recording at night with Doug, because that's what he used to do as a hobby. And their wives noticed they were racking up a lot of miles in the car and said, like, you know, where exactly are you going? And questions were asked, and then eventually Doug kind of owned up and said, look, you know, and showed his wife the book of designs and the newspaper clippings he'd been keeping, and he said, that's us, we're doing it.
What was Doug like as a person? You know, so what sort of chap was he?
Well, in the few times I met him, he was a very nice chap, you know, invited me into his studio, gave us tea and biscuits, and, you know, very happy to spend as much time as we needed to do interview work with him. And I met him on a few occasions, and he seemed very amiable. And and certainly what surprised me was looking at his studio. You know, he's got all these artworks on the walls, a lot of which are his own art. And he's a very accomplished, professional, high-grade, what I would class as realist, you know, realist artist, you know, very detailed artwork, you know, like on the scale of like Constables, things like that.
So whereabouts was his artist studio then?
Down in Southampton. And he also provided framing services as well as prints. But, you know, little did people know that this quiet shop with an artist there was actually responsible for what became a worldwide phenomena and will probably go down in history as being, you know, remembered as a sort of strange thing for many years to come. You
but
know?
See, some people still maintain that there are circles that could not possibly be made by humans.
Well, this is where you cross into the Twilight Zone, because the man-made circles are the real circles, and the man-made circles do generate paranormal phenomena. And we've even taken teams of scientists out with equipment who've measured a field when, you know, before we've started, their equipment hasn't shown up any readings. And then we've made something which is just a symbol for a digital radio, DAB. We were making a symbol. They paid for the field. So we made this just commercial circle in daylight hours. And for no apparent reason, the equipment went off the end of the scale. They were getting readings on their equipment like they'd never seen before. But the thing is, we do... I've started making circles, and I don't want to make this about me. This is, should be about Doug, but I mean, I make circles and believe in this paranormal aspect now. And you know, the real circles are the man-made circles, and they are the paranormal circles.
So, would you deny that? That would you say that any circle can be man-made? Because there are people that really do say this. As I say again, they say that this circle could never be made by a human.
Well, I actually choose the reverse way of looking at this, because I think that the researchers have forgotten the original phenomena, which is simple circles. If you go back to the 1500s, there are woodcuts depicting what was known then as the mowing devil, which is the this circle that appeared behind a farmer's house when he was approached by somebody who offered his services to cut the field for him, to mow the field with his scythe, and this farmer said, no, I don't need those services. And the guy that was offering this service said, well, I smite you then, and sort of walked off into the night, and that was it. And then in the morning there was a circle in the field, and the farmer was so, you know, scared by this that that the way it had been cut down was in the shape of a circle, and it was cut down so precisely that he thought it was the work of the devil. And I think he probably sought, you know, counsel with his local priest and the church because of it. And the story was reported. It was a woodcut. We know that this happened. And many circles have happened throughout history. So there is an original phenomena. But I think you can probably infer from that story that guy who knocked on the farmer's door may have been the one who made the circle. But, of course, you know, there are circles that have appeared in farmers' fields. We don't know who's made them, but they too tend to be the simple swirls and could almost be mistaken as wind damage. Now, unfortunately, these are the circles which are now thrown out as being the rubbish, the man-made, not interested. Researchers can't be bothered with those. And I think they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, because the scale of believability for many researchers is the more complicated it gets, the more it can't be made by people. What I believe, the reverse is true. It slowly got more and more complicated as more and more artist teams have got more proficient. But now they're not interested in the real phenomena anymore. They're only interested in the complicated. So the more complicated, the more it can't be done by people. And that is the indicator that shows you it is done by people.
So, I mean, you were talking about the planks and the boards and things like that earlier. What about some, you know, modern... I mean, to make these really complicated ones, what kind of equipment is used?
Mostly still planks of wood. And it's a design on paper. Is the most important thing. You have to get this accurate, and you have to take the measurements very, very accurately with a ruler off the paper, and then you scale them up. And the same tools that you use on paper will be the same things you use out in the field effectively. A compass with a pencil, which is what you draw on paper, will become a person standing with a surveyor's tape measure, holding it out to a measured distance. And the pencil becomes the person at the other end who's actually stepping sideways, stomp, stomp, stomp with his feet sideways, creating this pencil line, which is the circle. So that's how you start. You start with a circle, usually, and then around the edge of the circle, you can mark in measurements, which you either put posts in the ground, or you can put little white paper plates that some people use, and they put a stone on top of them. Some way to measure and mark out the edges of the design with certain distances, and from these distances you can actually start to line in across the circle, holding a tape measure in straight lines across the circle, and you can actually produce any myriad amount of patterns or shapes with this type of method. The only other method which I know that has been used which has gone beyond that is what you could kind of call a dot matrix effect, which is that you would have to square out a field into a set of squares, which means that you measure set squares across the top and set squares down the side, and you create a crosshatch of lines, verticals and horizontals across the field, and then you just decide which ones have to be filled in black and which ones are left white. So you basically make up a pattern of whatever it could be, a face. There's been alien faces, there's been Richard and Judy have been had their face done with this method. I mean, it's all been done in a very similar style or technique, but that's the only other way that it's ever been done. It's either done with circular scribing or dot matrix patterns. Those are the most proficient technical methods that have ever been used.
If Doug was still with us, what message would he have, Matt, do you think, for people who are still looking at crop circles, scratching their head and saying, good God, this is an incredible phenomenon.
I think Doug was very pleased that people decided to carry on from where they'd kind of left it. Their designs were the ones that started it off. They were simple circles which progressed into lines, joining two circles together with a line, sometimes known as dumbbells, and then keys and F shapes and strange little things that ended up looking like totem poles almost. Those were the early ones, and then other artist teams seem to take it onto a whole new level with very complicated geometric designs, and that pleased Doug and Dave no end. And I know he worked very closely with a team in London called the Circle Makers, and they've made very impressive designs over the years, as have many teams all over the world. And it's really spawned a kind of anonymous art form, which is, I believe, something unique in many ways, because it's an art form where most of the teams don't try to claim their work. And it's been described by people like Rob Irving, who's a circle maker. Now he's a Dr. Robert Irving in mythology, of all things. But he says that if you claim a circle, you kill it. You know, it takes away all the magic, it takes away all the mystery. So really, a circle is designed to be put out there and for people to make their own minds up. And the better the circle and the more mysterious that you can create it, maybe with some sort of magic elements and positive intent. I believe positive intent is the best way to do it. Wanting people, you know, to have the best that they can from this design. And I was asking the universe for guidance when I went out and made mine. You know, I used to say, hey, universe, give us the inspiration to kind of make this circle great. And when we'd finish, we'd kind of bless it into the, you know, into the society to kind of do its own thing. And I think that positive intent has kind of helped our circles work, you know, work well for people. I think Doug was pleased that it's carried on. And towards the end, he was quoted as saying he didn't think it would ever die. He thought there would always be circles now. And that's his legacy, you know.
What about your own work? Because I know you've got quite a lot of stuff online, YouTube. Whereabouts can we follow your stuff, Matt?
Well, if people can stand the bad language, because I definitely take off my polite hat and my shirt and tie and the former UFO researcher self that I used to be years ago, and I say, look, you know, crop circles, we have to take this with a bit of humour. If people could take this kind of bad language I use, which I've been criticised for and I apologise for in advance, then they can look at a show I did called Circle Makers TV, where we interview the circle makers, sometimes anonymously because they've got jobs and kids and they don't want their kids pulled out of school for daddy being a naughty illegal circle maker and whatnot. And but they come on the show and they talk about why they do it and what their influences are. And something that interested me a lot was to ask the question, have you ever had any paranormal experiences whilst making the circles? Do you feel you've been influenced in any way to kind of do these things? Have you had any coincidences in the designs you've done and other things that have taken place? I mean, things like two teams going out to the same field at the same night and doing similar designs. Both teams didn't know that the other team was there. Strange things like that. I got the inspiration to go out and do a design that people were sitting about 200 feet away for meditating, asking for that shape. I came to that field, got an urge to do it, that circle on my own that night, came there, did it. These are the paranormal things that we kind of wanted to share with the world, to say there are strange things going on in man-made circles. The circle makers are not in control of that. We don't make that happen. That's something else doing it, you know, and we don't know whether it's a group mind like telepathy or whether it's some other force, whether it's God or aliens or something that's kind of willing us to go out there and make these shapes for other people's benefit. But I think, as I said, Doug even believed that he was being guided towards the end because some of the strange things that happened to him. Do you know he was hit on the head by a chemical toilet waste from a plane and knocked unconscious one night? Yeah, I mean, that he found that as a kind of a wry joke to kind of, what's the odds of that? You know, you're making a crop circle and suddenly you're knocked unconscious. And when you haven't even got a torch, he got taken back by Dave Chorley to his car, and he thought he had blood on his head. He thought somebody had come in and attacked him. And when they turned the car headlights on, he was covered in bluey green gunge, you know, which is a bit smelly. And they worked it out in the end. It was chemical waste from an aircraft that had gone over that had kind of probably congealed and frozen on the way down, and then was semi sort of solid by the time it hit him and knocked him unconscious. Yeah, I mean, you know, if that isn't a proof of a cosmic joker out there, I don't know what is.
What about, you mentioned briefly there the legalities of it, and you said also that you were the only person ever to be arrested for making a crop circle. Surely it's just, I mean, you know, it's criminal damage. Do people get permission first? And if they do, then that does destroy the anonymity.
Well, if people did get permission first, the farmer might be paid and might be in on it, but that very rarely happens unless it's a commercial job or a television company wanting to see you demonstrate how this is done. Most crop circles are done illegally because the artists just literally scour the countryside for what looks like the best canvas, which might be based on location or it might be the quality of the crop in the field. So if any farmers are listening, take it as a read that if you have a circle on your land, you've got good quality crops. So thumbs up, well done, farmer. But they don't ask permission. They go and do it there illegally. And yes, if they get caught like I did, you get done for criminal damage. And I got fined £100, which I thought was quite lenient. I thought the magistrate was sort of on my side, actually. I kind of wondered why I was this artist who brings a lot of tourism to the area was kind of getting pulled before the courts for his Banksy-like behaviour. But and I'm not on a Banksy level, by the way. I'm not trying to say that at all. In fact, edit that out. You know, still, the art that we do anonymously is kind of... It is liked by a lot of people, but it is illegal. If you do get caught, you will get arrested, prosecuted, have 16 police officers come to the house and turn the house upside down, take your computers away, smash them up, tell them that, you know, they were just smashed through fair wear and tear. You know, all the sort of tricks that, you know, that they could pull to kind of let you know that they don't like you.
It's another reason why people might be doing this stuff at night.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good reason to kind of say to people, I mean, I've kind of tested the waters with seeing what happens when you get caught for this stuff. And is it really worth coming out and letting your name be known? Yes, maybe let your name be known, but maybe not claim the work. Don't let it be attached to you in saying this is actually my stuff, because if they can attach you to a circle, then they've got the grounds to come and arrest you because you've admitted to a specific thing. So maybe don't be too specific. But anyway, what were we saying? Illegality? Yeah, it is illegal, but it's also a great art form, you know, and Banksy does exactly the same sort of stuff, graffiti artist. I wouldn't say most graffiti I would like, you know, in terms of, you know, scrawling names on walls, but if it's actual pictures and obviously shows that the artists are talented and they've got a message to tell. I think crop circles are good in that respect because they're not only anonymous by artist, they're ambiguous by what they mean because they are shapes, a lot of them, and you can read into what that shape means, but it's a double anonymity because it's not saying to you, hey, look, there's a picture of a house with an arrow pointing at it and telling you that the smoke is coming out of the chimney and smoke is bad. You know, it's not like a message, like an advert or a statement. It's ambiguous. You know, what does this shape mean? And is there a hidden message? And yes, there often is, but you have to go looking for it. So that crop circle can mean one thing to one person and mean something very different to somebody else. And that's a type of art that you don't see in galleries so much. You know, you can't take a field into a gallery. You can't take an illegal act into a gallery. You know, you have to visit it in the countryside. You have to visit it in situ. And that forces people to come out to the countryside and visit the countryside, which I think is a nice thing as well. You know, it brings people out into the real world away from Facebook.
What about the Crop Circle Visitor Centre? That's been a phenomenon for a few years, I think, now. Is the idea that people actually come from all over the world during the height of the summer?
Yeah, people are drawn to the crop circles because of, you know, their wonderment. They wonder whether or not they're paranormal. They want to get in them, sit in them, sleep in them, you know, take some crop home, plant that crop when they get back home and see what happens. You know, they're obviously drawn to Wiltshire because it's the epicenter of where things are happening. And I'm actually glad that some of the farmers have been cutting them out in the local area, because it was becoming a bit like a circus, whereby within a couple of miles square, you could actually just drive very quickly to all these crop circles. And the farmers were getting kind of fed up because it was the same thing every year, same fields. And now it's kind of forced the circle makers to think a little bit bigger, to think a bit further afield, and to explore the landscape themselves in the way that they drew people out of their armchairs to come and look at the crop circles in this lovely countryside. It was becoming boring seeing the same bit of countryside. So now the circle makers have had to expand their horizons and see new places in the countryside that are further afield, you know, and force people to drive 40 miles or 100 miles, and they're putting them further afield around the countryside. And this has come at the same time as the revolution in drone technology as well, because crop circles and aircraft, you know, have had to be used to photograph them. Now it's become drones that are doing it. It's kind of democratized the way that photography of circles can be done, so people can do them in much further afield areas and get the photography themselves or from a local drone pilot, you know, and not spend loads of money to do it. So crop circles are moving out of Wiltshire now. They're expanding. The bubble is kind of growing bigger, and we'll be seeing them in Scotland soon, I'm sure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Frances Meyer, and I've recently had my employment support allowance stopped because apparently I am too fit to claim it.
So what has that meant for you?
I'm trying to have it to reinstated, but it doesn't look good.
So how much a week are we talking about?
I can't recall exactly, but it's around about £60 a week, something like that.
Just tell us about your disability and your, you know, what sort of needs you've got as an individual.
Well, I was born with cerebral palsy, but that's not why I'm using crutches now. I'm using crutches because I was attacked in 2010, and I've been using crutches outdoors and a Zimmer frame indoors ever since.
So when you say employment support allowance,
yes,
what is that money? What are you getting that money for, and why have they decided that you don't require it anymore?
Apparently I'm too fit now.
Well, what do you mean by that?
I mean that they have decided I am capable of doing some work. Well, I could have told them that.
Well, maybe you shouldn't have had the benefit in the first place.
What makes you say that, Tony?
Well, because you're saying that if you're fit for work, then you don't need employment support allowance, do you? Or do you? What is this allowance? What's it for?
It's meant for people who basically either can't work or can't find the type of work that they need to do with the disability.
So effectively they're saying that you're fully mobile,
yeah,
and able to do almost anything.
That's correct.
Well, just tell us about your mobility, because you're not fully mobile at all, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm going to need crutches for outdoors for the rest of my life and a Zimmer frame indoors for the rest of my life. I can't balance without these mobility aids, but the government have decided that I can.
And so what are you doing to try and prove that you do need this extra money?
I've been to see a disability welfare officer today at the place that I volunteer at, Youth Education Service. She knows about these things. And she's taken down all my details, and she suggests that I go to my GP to get written evidence of what my impairment is. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to phone my GP tomorrow and get an appointment, but I probably won't get an appointment for about 3 weeks.
In the meantime, are you still getting the benefit, or has it been taken away?
It's been taken away. I'm basically living on my savings at the moment, what savings I've got.
You are fairly severely disabled, aren't
yes.
you? I mean, you know, you find it very difficult to, you can't get around at all without crutches.
That's right.
And even just, you know, you're sitting in the chair here in the studio now. It took you a couple of minutes just to get from one chair to the
That's
other
right.
chair.
That's correct.
So what do you think is the government's purpose in forcing you to jump through these hoops?
To make the unemployment figures look lower than they really are, as they always do.
Can you keep us in touch with how your appeal goes?
I certainly will.
And, you know, let us know about, you know, when and if you get this money, because I just find it appalling that somebody who's not a doctor at the Department for Work and Pensions, Esther Wonderful McVeigh's department, can just take away your money without actually even seeing you.
This is true. I was sent for an assessment for ESA. Initially, I got a letter, a few days later, I got a letter saying it had been granted. And then they changed their mind. Apparently, they sent a letter that told me I was granted ESA. It had been sent in error. Somebody pressed the wrong button on the computer, I expect.
OK, so you got that letter a couple of days after your assessment. How long after that were you told that the letter was in error?
Well, I went down, about 3 days later, I went down the stairs to see see if there was any mail for me, and there it was, the one telling me that I'd been refused it.
So was that, what, about a week after the assessment, or what?
Thereabouts, yeah.
And how long ago was that?
I think that was the beginning of last week.
Okay, so we're talking about maybe 2 weeks since you had the assessment.
That's right.
We'll keep track of this, Fran. Thanks very much for talking to us about this, because I think it's particularly worrying when you find the people who are the most vulnerable in society effectively being bullied. I mean, as you have been, if they've told you, yes, you've got your benefit, and then they we've changed our mind, that they really shouldn't be doing that.
I know that.
Is this the first time this sort of thing has happened?
No, because when I applied for personal independence payment that replaced disability living allowance, initially they turned me down until I took it to appeal, and then the appeal tribunal overturned it, and they sent me all the way to Weston-super-Mare for the assessment for that. But because I could get there without anybody helping me, they assumed that I didn't need PIP.
Right, so how long did it take you to get to Weston-super-Mare and back? How did you manage that?
Well, I went to the bus station, got on a bus to go to Weston-super-Mare, and it was about, I think the assessment that on that occasion was about 11 o'clock in the morning. I managed to get there in time, but I don't know how, because I didn't know where it was once I got off the bus. But I did get there in time. I got there with a few minutes to spare.
And what happened over that? You got it on appeal?
Yeah, so they turned me down initially, but then I took it to appeal, and then the appeal tribunal overturned the original decision.
So have you got any income from Esther McVeigh at the moment then?
Apparently, according to some people, if my ESA assessment has been turned down and refused, in the meantime, the rest of my benefits are going to be frozen. But I don't know whether that's true or not.
Anyway, keep us in touch, Fran. Thanks very much for joining us.
OK, thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Andy Worthington, talking about his film Concrete Soldiers, Matt Williams, talking about his friend and circle maker, Doug Bauer, and also Fran, you just heard from then. Thanks also to studio engineers Joss Chivers and Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. Or you can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. But meanwhile, thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, from us at Dialect, goodbye for now.
Legend says a beautiful Chinese girl called Chang'o has been living there for 4,000 years. It seems she was banished to the moon because she stole the pill of immortality from her husband. You might also look for her companion, a large Chinese rabbit, who is easy to spot since he is always standing on his hind feet in the shade of a cinnamon tree. The name of the rabbit is not reported.